Good morning. The court's ready to hear argument in Weinstein v. Roberts. Are you ready to proceed?
Yeah.
Mr. Scanlon? And while you're organizing your papers, I just want to remind you, when the clock starts, it'll show your total time. When the yellow light comes on, you'll be using your rebuttal time. You can continue, but you will be using that.
Thank you, Your Honor. Honor, Patrick Scanlon for the appellant, Alan Weinstein. This is a case in which Mr. Weinstein, CPA, was a solo practitioner, meaning he was a one-man shop. He testified at trial that he took into account the fact that he wasn't layered or leveraged by charging a lower hourly rate than CPAs who were in large diversified firms who had young accountants, paraprofessionals, clerks, and so forth. The testimony here...
Mr. Scanlon, before you tell us about the facts, tell us how the briefs just kind of leap to quantum merit. There seems to be this underlying assumption that if you don't have an engagement letter, that's the end of the inquiry. We just go to quantum merit. But it appears that there was a large outstanding bill and a substantial amount of money was paid to bring up the arrears. And then they went forward prospectively. And there would seem to have been some understanding that we've paid you a substantial sum for what we owe you. You've agreed to go forward. We're going to agree to go forward on the same historic basis we had, which would mean I'm going to charge you this hourly rate, which you're about to tell us factors in the situation he had in being a solo practitioner. And notwithstanding that history and that accommodation, we just go from no engagement letter to quantum merit. The history of the parties is almost irrelevant. We're just going to have an outside person come in and tell us what they think the services were worth. So how did we get to that legal proposition?
It was a leap, Your Honor. It wasn't argued at trial that the prior negotiations with the party established and approved the $100 an hour rate. It was argued at trial that the bills that were already paid when they were not disputed should not be reexamined. A slightly different issue, but related to what Your Honor raised.
Well, certainly the parties can frame the issues. So I guess as far as the parties are concerned, the history of the dealings is somewhat irrelevant except to the extent it relates to your quantum merit argument. Is that correct?
Not to the extent that we don't give up our argument made before the trial court and on appeal that the court should not have gone back and recomputed rates for work that was already paid for at a time that was undisputed.
So that relates to the blended rate argument over the number of years where the court did the averaging?
Yes, Your Honor. We argued at trial that it was unfair to go back to 1987 when what was in plaintiff's mind at dispute was the unpaid portion of the invoice. Now, this was a suit on an account, and so you have to have a starting point for that. And we did use an invoice from 1996 that showed, at that point, charges and payments made as of that date and gave a balance. That was our starting point. But by the time that this suit was filed, that invoice had been paid out on a first-in, first-out basis. And so we argue that the court was wrong to go back and reexamine every bill that was submitted from 1987 simply because the bill, the unpaid portion of the account, was on a quantum merit basis.
Well, did you amend your complaint after the payment was made? you said that a portion of the payment was made before you got to trial, right?
Before the suit was filed, Your Honor. There were no payments made after suit was filed, and there was a hiatus of...
Okay, so wait a second. If you're saying that a payment was made before the suit was filed, then I assume your complaint did not include the amounts that represented that payment or the services that represented that payment, right?
That's exactly true, Your Honor. What happened, though, is that when we went to trial, it was a suit on an account. So to show where we were and what was unpaid, it was necessary to go back to a beginning point. And the beginning point was the invoice from 1996.
Which you say has been paid.
Which had been paid at the time the suit was filed. It was introduced into the evidence so that we could have a clear accounting from the beginning to where we were. Otherwise, without a starting point, you can't really have an account.
So this was a running account?
Yes, Your Honor. The payments that were made on it were in round numbers, usually $5,000, $1,000, so forth. The details are in the exhibits. But it was lump sum payments, and there was April Kern's testimony on that point was when they had some money, they sent some to Alan Weinstein.
Well, that's where the arguments seem to be like ships passing in the night. You're characterizing this as a payment on an account. Your evidence was, here's what we did, here's what was paid, here's the balance due, please give us a check. And the other side is taking the position, we really don't have an arrangement. What we have are several years of accounting work. You, the court, need to tell us what that accounting work is worth and then award a judgment in that amount. Isn't that really the two divergent points of view?
Sort of, Your Honor, except that we did ask the court to set a value on several years of work. What we didn't ask the court to do is set a value on 14 years of work. And therein lies some of the problem.
How are we to address on appeal the circumstance that the trial court found your client not to be credible? And you're about to tell us a series of things about what your client testified to, but don't we have an express finding that your client was not credible?
He found that the most credible evidence was Mr. Doan's, but the issue was the value of his service. There was no question of padding of time. The question is whether or not $100 an hour was a fair value. The mistake that the court made was taking the $100 an hour that Mr. Weinstein charged for the mixed bag of work that he did and defining it as the partner's rate. There was testimony as to the reasonable value of his work. There was specific testimony by Mr. Rommel, who testified that it was, in fact, a reasonable charge and that it was within the range of what was charged by others for similar work. I submit that that's exactly the issue. Mr. Doan was asked what would have been a paraprofessional bookkeeper rate in 2001 by his attorney. He sidestepped that issue. He said half of the partner rate.
I don't want to belabor this issue, but that's what's confusing about the record. It's one thing to have someone come in and say to a solo practitioner, I'd like to engage your services. The answer is it's $100 an hour. You need to understand I'll be doing accounting work, I'll be doing paraprofessional work, and I'll be doing secretarial work, and I'll be doing bookkeeping. But when the clock is running, no matter what I'm doing, it's $100. And you say, fine, I'm going to pay you $100 because I want you to do it, even though you're not going to be doing the accounting work full time. Conversely, you could be saying, what's it worth? And then what the court apparently said is, well, I'll give you $100 when you're functioning as an accountant. I'll give you X dollars when you're functioning as a paraprofessional, and I'll give you less money when you're doing clerical work. And that's what the court did in this case, isn't it? It didn't talk about a contract with an individual to pay a fixed hourly rate no matter what the nature of the work was. The court said, I'm going to look at the total work done with 20/20 hindsight and value it.
Yes and no. He didn't do the valuing part. What he did, and it's clear from the opinion and the reference to the exhibit, that instead of saying your work is worth so many dollars an hour, he took the average of what Alan Weinstein actually billed and then assumed that that was the partner rate that Mr. Doan described. Mr. Doan, I tried to nail him down on what a paraprofessional rate would be in his firm. And based on his rate at the time of trial, which is admittedly several years after the time frame, that his paraprofessional rate would have been $92.50 an hour. And in fact, if you use those rates, the bill would be much larger than what Mr. Weinstein billed. I asked Mr. Doan what his rate was in 2001. He said he didn't know. There was no testimony from the defense that this bill was unfairly large, that it was overcharged. The only testimony was this criticism of the fact that he was a solo practitioner and that he was doing a mixed bag of work at one rate. There's nothing inherent, and I believe that the court erroneously made a rule of law, that accountants just can't do that. And I submit that that in this situation, the court erred because it didn't find the value of the work. It really just took the average of what he actually billed, and he ruled based on the assumption that Doan made. He admits it is an assumption that the actual rate was the partner rate. And the other testimony in the trial from Mr. Rommel was that, in fact, it was a fair rate for what was charged. George Deal testified that he was charging $90 an hour at the time to his other clients. And Alan Weinstein testified that he was charging $100 an hour to his other clients at the time. So,
well, in this case, is the Superior Court's decision consistent with Doan's testimony?
Yes and no. It's consistent that he took that rationale. But it's not based on any testimony that Doan gave as to the value of the work, because he did not testify to that. He testified that whatever the partner rate was, that the paraprofessional rate should be half of that. But he missed the crucial nexus, that is, what was an appropriate partner rate for someone who wasn't a partner. Mr. Weinstein had no partners. He had no partner rate. He had this sole rate that he charged for doing everything. And I submit that we didn't hear that testimony because the defendant couldn't get the testimony that it was an overcharge. When Rommel testified that it was a fair charge, defense totally ignored that testimony on cross-examination. I asked why. Well, because a good trial attorney, he knew it wasn't going to get anywhere. They didn't have any evidence that this was really overcharged. Court based its ruling on an assumption. It was not a reasonable assumption. Wait, not based on fact.
Could it be described as an inference instead of an assumption?
You have to have inference from evidence. There was no testimony that the work was not worth what was charged.
I thought there was an issue of independence of your client.
There was a question of independence. And that didn't apply to anything that really affected the value of the work. The independence issue was that Mr. Weinstein issued a report, a review report, which he should not have issued because he was owed money. It wasn't because he didn't do the work necessary to issue a review report, but simply that he was owed money and therefore shouldn't have put his signature to it because he wasn't disinterested. That didn't cost the defendant anything. He just got more than he was entitled to.
You have about 5 minutes. Would you like to reserve that time?
I would, Your Honor.
Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is David Hutt. I'm with Wilson, Howard, and Byard. We represent the defendants, or the defendants in the court below, the appellees here. As was just noted, this is a case that, as the Court noted, is about quantum merit. Both of the briefs address the quantum merit issue. As Mr. Scanlon candidly admitted, that's how the issues were framed in the court below. The court was determining the reasonable value or worth of the accounting services that were rendered, and that's what the court did. Obviously, the plaintiff below is dissatisfied with the outcome of that and does not like the fact that the reasonable value or worth of those services was not what he thinks that they were. But I mean,
doesn't the court's decision have to be based upon evidence? And was there any evidence that the amount he was charging was other than a reasonable amount?
I believe there was, Your Honor. And what the court did, it indicated, was it looked at what the plaintiff was charging, what the CPA was charging, and then rather than deduct the number of hours for work that was inefficient or valueless because of the lack of independence, or as the court referred to as the business advice being just simply off the mark, and the court, rather than deducting a physical number of hours, or an actual number of hours, instead used the reduced rate to account for that.
Well, but was there any breakdown of 300 hours, 20 hours spent doing this report that was not independent, 14 hours giving business advice that was or wasn't valuable, 12 hours doing bookkeeping, 6 hours doing CPA work, whatever. I mean, the court did some broad brush kind of adjustments, but what was the basis for that in terms of what evidence was there to support that?
In addition to the things that I just listed, I would say the other evidence is that the disparity between the type of work that was being performed, whether it be paraprofessional or professional work.
Right, but was there a breakdown of how many hours were spent doing work that could be described as paraprofessional versus how many hours were spent doing CPA work?
Mr. Doan, in his report, went through and compared it to what his firm presently did and the breakdown between paraprofessional and professional at his firm. And in fact, he used the first year that his firm took over and began to do that account. And as his testimony was, ever since then, the amount in time and the actual amount of expense here has significantly decreased because of the efficiencies that were involved.
Explain how Mr. Doan's report leads to the outcome in this case, or his testimony. How do you get from point A to point B? Because that's the evidence, isn't it, that you're relying upon?
That is, Your Honor. I believe that's the evidence that the court indicated in its opinion that it relied upon. I stated that it found Mr. Doan's report to be the most credible evidence on the subject of the worth of the services that were rendered. I believe that what the court did was it looked at the spreadsheet that Mr. Doan prepared, which differentiated between professional and paraprofessional time, and allotted the reduced rate, which factored in the lack of independence and the other the fact that some of the advice was simply off the mark and untimely. It factored all those things in and arrived at a number that was very similar and within a dollar or so of Mr. Doan's number in his report, and then applied that to the running account that had been there.
Yep. And your clients at one time paid $100,000 towards the past bill, is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So they had this history of dealing. They knew what they were getting, and they wanted their tax returns done prospectively because when they went to Weinstein, they had a problem. Is that correct? And he agreed to do these returns that hadn't been filed.
I think that's a general history of the matter.
Well, if they have this history of dealing and your client makes the payment on the account due, and they seem to have decided to go forward prospectively on the same basis, so why shouldn't he get paid for his normal hourly rate even though he's doing a lot of different things?
What the timing of some of that is going to be part of my answer. The $100,000 payment was not immediately contemporaneous with those events. There is some time that takes place between all of these. I mean, it's a 14-year history, so I mean, all of these things kind of
well, I understand,
are spread
but
out.
If you look at Doan's testimony and you look at what Deal did later on, we have the court saying, well, you know, Mr. Weinstein was a little antiquated in his practices. He was doing things by hand. He wasn't doing a computer. It was a one-man office. And if you look at what was going on here and you charge the higher hourly rate, it's really not fair. But that was the history of these parties' relationship, wasn't it?
It was the history of how the bills were being issued, but the bills were not being paid. Every year the accountant would, in round numbers or something, bill $20,000 and receive a much less part of that. There's never, I think the nature, and that's one of the difficulties in this case that I think the Superior Court and this court now faces, is there was never, you received an invoice for $20,000 where my clients would walk in and say, that's reasonable, here's your check for $20,000. We had four invoices in 14 years, sporadic, in addition to the sporadic billing, there's sporadic payments. So I think that's what the court was attempting to place values on and resolve.
So are you saying that your clients testified that they never agreed to $100 an hour?
That's correct. There was never, Your Honor, there was never any discussion like that. And obviously, as the record shows, there's no engagement letter or management letter.
Right. So, but in terms of the payments that were made when bills were submitted or sometime after bills were submitted, were those payments made with a notation saying, you know, we protest the rest of your bill and this is all we're paying you for your $20,000 bill, we're paying you $5,000?
No, there was never that level of communication between the parties, Your Honor.
So it, from an objective appearance, it would seem as if a bill was submitted and a partial payment was being made because your clients had financial difficulties, and that the accountant was accepting partial payment because he knew that the client couldn't make full payment right now. I mean, isn't that the objective fact of what happened?
That's up until later in the relationship, yes.
All right, and I guess getting back to what Justice Holland was asking about, if you receive a bill for services and you accept that bill by making partial payment on it and not saying anything other than, gee, can you hold off on the rest because I don't have enough money right now, doesn't that indicate that you've agreed to the amount being charged?
I don't believe it does, and particularly not given the history, the billing history, or lack there, more, I guess, more correctly, the lack thereof in this matter. a CPA began doing work in 87, and the first bill that he sends out is in 1996 or 5. I don't recall. But it's, I think it's 8 years later. I don't believe the payments that were made between 87 and 95 or 96, I don't believe would reflect any type of a meeting of the minds or anything like that between parties when there's this kind of open amorphous account out there that accumulates money but isn't billed. There's no invoices out there for the first 8 years. And that's those are the difficulties, and frankly, they're difficulties that the CPA created himself. It's his responsibility to go out and draft the engagement letter and sit down with my clients and say, this is the rate that I'm going to bill you at, and as you can see, I don't use computers, I don't have a staff, it's all me. And it's his job to have that engagement letter, and if he does have that engagement letter and it's signed by my clients and everybody agrees on that, then we don't look at and evaluate the reasonable worth or value of those services. We don't have Mr. Doan come back in and say 68 or basically 70% of the time the CPA in this case was basically doing clerical work or bookkeeping work that could have been that the reasonable value of that service is much less than what was being billed. And so that's the evidence that the judge in the court below had before him and relied upon in determining the reasonable value of this open and running account for 14 years.
How is Mr. Doan's testimony directly related to the expertise provided here? If we make an analogy to lawyers in Delaware, we have law firms in Wilmington with 100 lawyers, law firms in Kent and Sussex with maybe 5 lawyers, and then some people are solo practitioners. If you had a solo practitioner disputing a bill, whether it's for the plaintiff or the defendant, if you make analogies to partners, associates, paralegals, and clerical people in Wilmington, it may not be directly on point. What evidence did Mr. Doan present that really related to a person running their own office as opposed to a partner in a larger accounting firm?
I think that what Mr. Doan did, I think he testified to this, was he assumed that that was a reasonable rate, that Mr. Doan's rate for his CPA time, that was the reasonable rate. He went for a one-man accountant practice, $100 an hour was a reasonable rate. And then from that, he extrapolated back the 14-year history and provided that analysis between professional and paraprofessional work.
But why would you ever make that breakdown in an individual office if by the nature of the office, all individual accountants were doing that mix of work?
Because we're into a quantum Merowit analysis, looking at the reasonable value of the services that were rendered, the service that was being rendered for about 70% of the time was not that of a CPA. It was basically, I guess, data entry that could have been handled by a bookkeeper or some other paraprofessional or lower-tier employee.
But aren't you kind of putting the rabbit in the hat, because you're saying that 70% of the work was not work that would ordinarily be done by a CPA. Well, that's fine if you're talking about a firm that has other than CPAs in it and that has paraprofessionals and clerks and what have you. This was an office that had nobody else, so by definition, all of the work was work done by a CPA. Why isn't that the proper way of looking at it, as opposed to imagining a different business environment than what actually existed?
Because I think under the quantum error analysis, you're looking at the reasonable value of the services rendered. And hypothetically, my clients, if they weren't having their accounting services being performed by the plaintiff below in this case, would have gone to a different accounting practice.
They didn't, though. And anybody who goes to this plaintiff to have accounting work is getting this plaintiff and only this plaintiff doing everything that needs to be done. And if a reasonable rate for that is $100 an hour, then that's what he gets. And it's not broken down by, well, today I'm wearing my bookkeeper hat and tomorrow I'm wearing my CPA hat. I'm the only person here and I'm doing the work.
And I agree that my clients chose to stay with this CPA. But theoretically and hypothetically, had they chosen somebody else, those efficiencies would have been there. So the reasonable value of that work, if you hired a contractor to roof a building and for some reason he decided to do it himself and it took him much longer than a company that would have brought in a crew and done it, but they could have done it for less, the reasonable value of roofing that roof is not based solely on that. Assuming there was no contract, as here.
If I understand your argument, and let's make an analogy to a lawyer, an individual lawyer. You go in and retain the lawyer, and the lawyer says, I'm going to charge you $100 an hour, and I want you to know I have no staff. Therefore, when I'm researching your legal argument, it's $100 an hour. When I'm writing the brief, it's $100 an hour. And when I'm typing the brief, it's $100 an hour. If you sign an engagement letter, absolutely no problem enforcing that. But in the absence of an engagement letter where you just say, I want you to represent me, I know you don't have a staff, I know you're charging me $100 an hour, at the end of the day, if the person decides not to pay you, then the court is going to say, well, you spent $100 an hour, you spent X hours doing research, we'll multiply that by 100, but you spent Y hours doing typing, and we're going to multiply that by a fifth of 100 or something like that. And that's your case.
Essentially, yes, Your Honor, is the lack of an express engagement letter which you just described is the difficulty that Mr. Scanlon's client finds himself in, and that's why the court had to do this evaluation, which is admittedly a difficult evaluation for an open account for 14 years.
So even though the discounting was done as to the fee or the rate as opposed to the hours, you're saying that it's the equivalent and that the evidence supports that it's the equivalent?
I believe that there was never any reckoning to determine equivalency. The court decided to, rather than to determine the number, to perform some determination and eliminate some number of hours from its equation to adjust it. I think the court's attorney expressly said that it, rather than reduce hours, it was going to factor in the reduced rate and determine the reasonable rate of the services based on that.
Well, why shouldn't the rate have been reduced by another 10%? Or why shouldn't the rate have been reduced by 10% less than it was reduced? I mean, doesn't it have to correlate with something, or is it just, I think this is what's fair, and that's the rate it's going to be?
But the court below indicates that it relied upon Mr. Doan's report, and what Mr. Doan did was he did an analysis that assumed all of the work was valid work and efficient work. And if you use that assumption, which was the benefit of the doubt that was being given to the CPA, then what the court did, and Mr. Doan did, was basically to average those his fees and then multiply that out, apply a paraprofessional rate and multiply that out by the number of hours. Just finish the math, if you were.
So the trial judge essentially adopted Mr. Doan's analysis here?
I believe he did, and I believe, that he expressly stated that he found his to be the most credible testimony, and in fact he increased the hourly rate a little bit from Mr. Doan's report.
So he gave more money than Mr. Doan would have?
I think by a dollar or so an hour, correct, Your Honor. This, in my mind, and I think as some of the questions have revealed, this case demonstrates two important things for all professionals, and one, that is the merit of having an express engagement letter, and two, if you don't have one and you end up in the difficult position of suing your client, those things always tend to reveal things about your practice that you would not want revealed, and perhaps inadequacies in your practice. The evidence in the court below, as relied upon, is particularly the Doan report by the Superior Court below, provided the court with a logical and reasoned approach to determining the reasonable value of the services that were rendered by the CPA in this case. My clients would respectfully request that the court affirm the decision of the court below.
Thank you.
Your Honors, court had asked about the invoice at A-297, the invoice for $97,400 was the last invoice for work billed on this. There may have been some invoices adding finance charges, but that invoice of March 29 was the last invoice for work. The $100,000 payment was made on May 15th, approximately 6 weeks later. There's been some questions from the court and answers from the defendant about inefficiencies. The court criticized Mr. Weinstein for not using computerized bookkeeping account, but totally failed to account for the fact that George Deal, who did the lion's share of the work for that last billing, was using a computer, did use QuickBooks, the common thing, and there's no reason to discount the work that he was doing for any kind of inefficiency.
Well, Mr. Scanlon, just so we're clear before you finish your argument, tell us if there was a legal error, and if there was a legal error, tell us clearly what the legal error was, and if instead or in addition you think there was a factual error, tell us what the factual error in the court's decision was. So let's start. What was the legal error in what the Superior Court did?
The legal error was to make a finding of fact about the reasonable rate without any evidence to support it. That is, that the fair value of his work as a partner rate should be $86 an hour. It's clear from the court's opinion and examination of the documents, the exhibits referred to by the court in the opinion, that what the court simply did was rather than establish in his own mind what the testimony showed as a reasonable rate, took the average rate billed by Mr. Weinstein over the 14-year period of this engagement. Another error, whether it's a fact of law, is to fail to take into account that during the 2000-2001 period, the record keeping was computerized to the great part, and the court erred as a matter of law, I believe, in ruling that an accountant may not charge one flat rate for a bundle of services that in a larger accounting firm might be divided between senior partner accountants, paraprofessionals, and maybe even clerks. There is no basis in evidence, and that sounds like a ruling of law to me, that principle should be applied. The real focus on this should have been was the charge that resulted from this billing, fair and reasonable concerning the work that was performed. In his argument, the defendant gives the analogy of the roofer who spends too much time doing the roofing. Well, I think that's exactly the inquiry. Is if you had gone to any average other accounting firm and had the same work done, would the bill be different? And the only testimony on that, really, or the prime testimony on that, is Mr. Rommel, whose unrebutted, uncontested testimony was that, yes, it was fair, it was within the range of what was being, what would be charged by other accountants at the time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both. The court will take this matter under advisement and take a brief recess.